At Avocado, we know that not all mattresses are created equal. While other beds trap heat, ours sets it free. Made without polyurethane foams and crafted with natural latex, cotton, and wool. Breathable, comfortable, and supportive. No overheating, just clean, organic sleep that performs. Save 15% on our award-winning mattresses this July 4th sale. Avocado, celebrate organic. Shop at avocadomattress.com or leading retailers nationwide.
The Pat Kenny Show.
With Timber Living Log Cabins.
Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. on News Talk. Conversation that counts.
Well, now, the headlines about Venezuela are pretty terrible. Venezuela is coming to terms with a scene of deep and widespread devastation. Entire communities have been upended. Families still desperately searching for missing loved ones. In the midst of all the uncertainty, local volunteers are continuing their efforts, working against the clock in the hope of finding survivors. As you'll hear from this report on Sky News, James Matthews has been reporting on the ground in Venezuela.
I'm by the shore in a town called Catiel Amar. It's northwest of Caracas. And in this place, I think we get a clear sense of the devastation, certainly, and how that has impacted on the local people here. Take a look high right, and you can see the multi-story blocks that were once built here as luxury flats. They are now crumpled, some almost completely razed to the ground. And they are currently being searched at a height by some volunteers. Closer to me here in the foreground, well, this is a grim scene being duplicated right across this region. Rescuers here have found a body. They're not official rescuers because the police fire brigade official resources have been stretched to the extent the local people have been doing this job essentially by hand, using pickaxes, gardening tools, trying to find survivors, trying to find their loved ones. I was round the corner and, you know, members, generations of families have been shouting, screaming into the rubble, shouting the names of their loved ones, women, children. I had one aunt shouting the names Maria, Christopher, youngsters that she had lost in the earthquake. No sign of them alive, but largely it's the very worst news that people are coming to terms with here. They had the shock, clearly, of the earthquake, an initial escape for these people, but in the 48 hours since, it's been a question of this: looking in the rubble, looking for survivors, a race against time, because where there are survivors, they have a finite time in which they will remain alive. So there is a real sense of urgency, a sense of desperation here, and ultimately for many people, a sense of despair. You get an acute sense of how this earthquake has impacted on this place. You know, there is silence sometimes as you listen for sound. There is certainly the smell of death, and it is for these people looking for their loved ones in their town a most grotesque scene.
And that report from James Matthews of Sky News. And don't forget, tens of thousands of people are still missing and time may well be running out for many of them. And I'm wondering how that report might have triggered my next guest, because his career had two distinct phases. He was the face of both ITN's international coverage and presenter of their flagship News at 10. He ultimately left the world of news behind him and embraced classical music, which was a lifelong passion. We'll talk about both of those aspects of his career. John Soucey, good morning and welcome.
Thank you, Pat. Good to be with you.
I'm wondering how triggering was that description from James for you, because yes, you have been that soldier.
Absolutely. I was thinking, listening to it, you know, the big difference between television news today and in my day, which, let's face it, was almost 50 years ago, is 24-hour news. Sky News, that you've just played that report from, it's on air 24-7. I was working for News at 10. So I had all day to put the piece together and then satellite it to London, being very cognizant of the time difference and all that sort of thing. And once the piece aired on News at 10, I'd go to bed and work the next day for the next day's piece. But these reporters now on 24-hour news, they just never rest. I mean, it's extraordinary, and they are so good. James Matthews there, you know, he's probably been up for 24 or 48 hours on a story of this magnitude, and yet he still turns in first-class eyewitness reports by satellite, live by satellite, which is another thing that you couldn't do in my day. So how the world of TV news has changed.
I remember when I was working on in Current Affairs on RTE television, and I realized the end was nigh for what we were doing, because we had sent a reporter over to interview Muammar Gaddafi. And she was left outside the tent for a couple of days. And eventually we got the report back from her. It was on film, and then it was processed and we had it ready for transmission, probably maybe a week after the report had, the interview had been done. And the night it went out on a program called Today Tonight, and I was sitting there and we watched the output of the program, and then we switched over to ITN. And what I saw was Sandy Gall, yes, on the back of a donkey,
yeah,
broadcasting by satellite from Afghanistan.
Yes.
And I thought, we can never compete with that.
Yes, yes. You're so right. You know, I actually covered Afghanistan before Sandy. I went in with the Mujahideen soon after the Soviet invasion, the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. And I was not able to broadcast by satellite from Afghanistan because the birds, as we call them, the bird wasn't flying in those days. A year or two later, Sandy went in and he was able to report by satellite. So I was a reporter during the great transition between film. You mentioned film. Your reporter was working on film. For the first half of my reporting career, I worked on film. You had to get it processed. You had to get it back to London. You had to get it edited. Whereas once satellites were up and running, you could feed from wherever you were in the world straight up to the bird. And, you know, I believe, and this is a slightly controversial thing to say, Pat, but I believe that our industry, television news, helped bring about communism because, you know, when hundreds of thousands were flocking to the Berlin Wall in East Berlin, when communism was under threat in Moscow, Yeltsin was standing on a tank outside the parliament building, normally you would simply send out the soldiers with machine guns. You'd send in the tanks and they would kill people. But we were there on video by then, and we had satellites in the air, in space, and we could beam the pictures live as they happened. So the communists couldn't send out the tanks. They couldn't send out the machine guns. And I think in a small way, what we did helped bring about world change.
I remember vividly doing the stuff on film over the years because at the end of a particular sequence, then the cameraman would say, I just want to check the gate.
Yes.
Because
yes,
he'd had to check that there was no little filament of emulsion that had come like a hair across the gate and destroyed the pictures. Because you didn't know what you had until the film was processed.
Absolutely. And when I was in Iran almost 50 years ago and then Afghanistan, we were on film and I would stand at the cameraman's shoulder and make a note of every shot he took. We'd then go back to the hotel room or wherever we were staying, often in the tent on the hillside, and I would record what we called a wild track. So I would record a voice track, type it up on my portable typewriter, put it together with the sealed up can, and try and ship it back to London by aeroplane. And the editor in London would marry the words to the picture. And that's how we did it in the days of film. And everything, by definition, was 24 hours late, or as you said, several days late.
It sounds like the Stone Age to many of our listeners.
Yes.
News, therefore, has changed utterly. But are you still a news junkie? I mean, do you feel you've got to check your feeds on your phone first thing in the morning and last thing at night?
Do you know, absolutely 100% and completely, Pat. And I'll say something a little bit controversial. You know, my most treasured possession now, the thing that I could not live without, is my mobile phone. Because if I had had a mobile phone in my pocket in Iran or Afghanistan or the Philippines, I would have been able to use that phone to speak to the news desk in London, wherever I was in the world. I could transmit pictures live back to them. You know, wherever I went in the world as a reporter, the first question was, where's the nearest telephone? I need to call London. Now it's in my pocket, together with every note that Beethoven wrote, every note that Johann Strauss wrote, every note that, plus 10,000 photographs. I mean, these phones are a miracle. I know they can be abused. I know we've got to regulate them. But honestly, I said to my wife many times, you know, when I decide to check out and go to the big newsroom in the sky, put my phone in the wooden box with me, and whatever you do, don't forget the charger.
You're an optimist.
Yes, I am.
the repetitive nature, though, of the stories we're covering. Now, earthquakes are nature's way of readjusting the tectonic plates. We can't avoid those. But the things we could avoid, like the ongoing problems in the Middle East, you know, Iran, Israel, the United States, you've covered those stories again and again and again. Yes. Is it not depressing to see them once again top of the news agenda?
Well, I wouldn't use the word depressing. It's surprising. I mean, I covered the Iran Revolution. I flew back with Ayatollah Khomeini from exile in Paris to Tehran and covered the first modern Islamic revolution. And then we came back to London. We went back a few months later when they took 52 American hostages, paraded them around the embassy. You may remember that. Then we came back again and the story died away. And I thought, that's Iran dealt with. That's Iran done for. And look at it now. It's in the news almost every day, thanks to new developments there. Donald Trump deciding to fight Iran over the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. And, you know, a news colleague of mine once said a very sensible thing to me. Everything is secular. Everything is circular. Everything comes round again. There's no such thing as a linear. We don't live linear lives. Everything is cyclical.
Now, when you left news and embraced Classic FM, and you were hugely successful there for many decades, the point was you were going from, I suppose, one love to another more profound love, the love of music.
That's true, Pat. Yes. I mean, I even as a schoolboy, I was a bit of a geek. You know, my colleagues were into Bill Haley and the Comets and all that kind of thing. It was pre-Beatles. And I was into Tchaikovsky and Sibelius. And I've always loved classical music. And I became a reporter for ITN in 1976, which was just about the time the first Walkmans were produced. Suddenly you could take your music with you. And I remember being on an overnight ferry from Cyprus to Lebanon to cover the Lebanese civil war, steaming towards war when most sensible people would be coming in the opposite direction. And I had my Walkman in my pocket, one cassette tape, Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, and I played it into my ears again and again. So suddenly I was able to take my music with me. So I was able to indulge my passion, which helped my reporting.
Now, Beethoven has been a particular preoccupation. I mean, you mentioned other composers that you like, but Beethoven particularly. I'm fascinated myself by Beethoven because the first classical music I ever heard at home, my father bought a record of the Pastoral Symphony, the Sixth Symphony by Beethoven. And I remember him saying to me, my late father, he said, "It's extraordinary he wrote this while he was profoundly deaf." And when asked, he said, "I shall hear in heaven." Imagine writing something like the Pastoral Symphony and never hearing it played.
Absolutely. And I mean, your dad was dead right. The deafness began in his mid to late 20s, and it was a long, slow, gradual decline. It didn't become total deafness until he was in his mid 40s or late 40s, and he died at 56. But it didn't start till his mid to late 20s. So he knew what music sounded like. He wasn't born deaf. He knew what it sounded like, which is why he was able to continue to compose right through the deafness. And interestingly, the pastoral, which your dad played for, is the only piece of orchestral music Beethoven ever wrote in which he told us exactly what it was supposed to depict. You know, he put a title at the top of every movement. Mm-hmm. Happy feelings on arriving in the countryside, seen by the brook, the merry gathering of country folk, shepherds, the storm, shepherds' hymn of thanks. Other otherwise, with other compositions, he would say, don't try to read into my music, just listen to it. But he broke his own rule gloriously with the pastoral.
I want to read you a text from one of my listeners.
Yes.
I worked with John Suchet's father, who was a surgeon, a few decades ago. He was very proud of John, but worried that David would have problems being a success in the acting world. He need not have worried.
This is so true, Pat. It is so true. I have two brothers, and of the three of us, I'm the only one who went to university. And Dad was quite pleased about that. I had no idea what I was going to do. But when I decided in my final year, I said to him, look, I'm not too bad at modern languages, and I'm obsessed with the news. I'm going to try for Reuters News Agency, et cetera, et cetera. He said, okay, yeah, good. You've got your degree, something to fall back on. And my brother David, who is 2.25 years younger than me, I can still remember him as an 18-year-old sitting at the kitchen table with Dad, and Dad's thumping the table, over my dead body will you go to drama school? You'll never earn a living as an actor. And David just calmly saying to him, I'm sorry, Dad, that's what I'm going to do. And Dad did live to see his success, which is a nice thing.
By the way, the commenter says that your dad was very kind to me and had a great sense of humor.
Lovely.
So there you are. Now,
so
you are going to be in West Cork at the West Cork Literary Festival on the 17th of July.
Yes.
And your theme, I presume, will be Beethoven. But also, I'm sure you'll be asked questions about meeting your second wife after your first wife passed away. And I know Nuala's husband passed away, and that's how the two of you met. It's a great story, which we probably don't have time to recount here in any great detail. But Nuala's Irish.
She is indeed Finula, but known ever since childhood as Nuala. In fact, as I speak, she's listening to this in Dublin. She's with family, where there was a family wedding two nights ago. I wasn't able to go, so I'm here in Devon in England. But yes, she's Dublin born. And she was so pleased that I was asked to go to Cork, West Cork, because she's been saying to me for years, you love Cork. I must take you to Cork. Beautiful, cultured, artistic city, and Bantry, where we'll be, is beautiful. Sadly, we're only staying a couple of nights and then coming back again. But that is firmly on our list to go back there and then perhaps, you know, come up the wild Atlantic way. I've always wanted to do that. So, yep, she's Irish, Dublin born, yes.
And what can attendees at your talk on the 17th expect?
Well, this book, I mean, I hate the O word. There's something slightly wrong about an obsession, but I love the P word, passion. Beethoven's life and music has become my lifelong passion. And this book, Pat, it's my eighth book on him. And if I could just say very, 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 very quickly, it's not a biography of Beethoven. It is my story with Beethoven, and it was entirely Nuala's idea. We were sitting in the garden of a cottage outside Vienna where Beethoven lived at a very important moment in his life, and I was telling her the story of why and how, and she said, you've got to write it down, but not like all the others. I don't want to know about his life. Why Beethoven? What is your favorite music? When did you first hear his music? Why is it so important to you? And I turned to her, I actually said, well, I'll be lucky if that makes 10 pages. But it turned into a book, and that's what I'll be talking about.
And the book is called In Search of Beethoven.
Yes.
And it's out a while now. It's not brand new, so you might have to rummage around to get a copy of it or get it on Amazon or whatever. Anyway, in preparation for your visit, perhaps people might just do that, read your book, and then ask you informed questions thereafter.
That'd be nice.
I reckon you're going to have a great time in Bantry. And John, look, it's been a great pleasure talking to you, and thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Timber Living Log Cabins.